Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, and you're listening to Hank Jones Polysports here on Global Patriot Radio. Find us at blogtalkradio.com, where we talk politics and sports and those unfortunate times when the two collide, and they do collide a lot. But, hey, not today. Well, yeah, sort of today. Anyway, like I said, here I am at blogtalkradio.com on Global Patriot Radio Network, where we bring you 7 shows a week, 7 days a week with more than 7 hosts, but I don't know the exact number. It starts on Mondays, 6 o'clock Eastern Time, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mamma Mia No Sharia. Tuesdays, it's Eric with the Cross and Crescent discussion at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And then Wednesdays at 5:30, of course, you have me, Hank Jones, with Hank Jones Polysports. Thursdays, Paul Sutliff is in with the Sutliffian Report. Paul's in at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Friday at noon, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. Then Saturday nights at 10 p.m. to midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie, revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, Eric is back with a sort of continuation of the Cross and Crescent discussion called Real Interfaith Dialogue. And again, as a reminder, that one you need to download an app to be able to partake. You cannot just come in and partake because some real sleazeballs have come in and partaken and made it no fun for everyone, which sucks. I am here from Electric Hankland. The little Aussie is home. She's eaten. She's hyper as usual. The wife is at a conference today for work. She'll be back at some point, probably break in right in the middle of our show. But hey, it's her right. Okay, let's get to our obituaries. Last Thursday, we lost an actress. She played a minor part, admittedly, but a crucial one, considering the few lines that she did deliver. From one of the all-time great holiday movies, It's a Wonderful Life, Virginia Patton passed away at age 97. She was the last surviving adult actor who had received on-screen credit in the film, although several of the child actors are still alive, of course. But she retired from acting in 1949 to raise a family. And she, of course, played Ruth Dakin Bailey. Funny, her uncle was General George S. Patton. No background info needed on him, of course. She's studying acting at USC, where she then read for Frank Capra and got the part of Ruth Dakin, as I said, or rather, as she said, Ruth Dakin Bailey, if you don't mind, in that iconic holiday flick. She and her husband relocated to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she later finished her college courses at the University of Michigan. You know what? Given this last month's developments, that makes her a double Hawkeye rival when you think about it. Still, she played a crucial role where when she gave that line that introduced herself as Harry Bailey's wife, it all but sealed the small town fate of his big brother, George Bailey, played by the awesome Jimmy Stewart, and who was later said by Harry Bailey, "To my brother George, the richest man in town." Anyway, RIP to the final surviving on-screen credited cast member of It's a Wonderful Life, Ms. Virginia Patton. Friday, we lost 2 former athletes. First, we lost Major League Baseball guy John Walkenfuss. He played 11 seasons with the Detroit Tigers and Philadelphia Phillies from 1974 to 1985. He was determined by the Detroit media as the Tigers' most versatile and important player. He was able to play catcher, first base, outfield, served as designated hitter. Ironically, he was traded to the Phillies before the 1984 season, which brought the Tigers Tom Bergman and Willie Hernandez. Yeah, all Willie Hernandez did was win the AL Cy Young and MVP awards on the way to the Tigers winning their World Series title. And anyway, John Walkenfuss had been diagnosed with dementia in 2018. And then we also lost former NFLer Riddick Parker. He passed away suddenly while playing bicycling at the age of 49. Played college ball at North Carolina, and then he was with the Seahawks and the Patriots and the Ravens, won a Super Bowl title with the 2000 Patriots. Saturday, We lost former PGA and Champions Tour golfer Tom Weisskopf to pancreatic cancer. 79. 16 PGA titles between 1968 and 1982. He won the 1973 Open Championship at Troon. Oh, for God's sake, it's the British Open. We are Americans here. We can say it. Anyway, he also finished second at the Masters four times, along with a tie for second at the 1976 U.S. Open. His most famous tie for second probably was that 1975 Masters. He tied with Johnny Miller for second. Jack Nicklaus had a rather dramatic final round comeback to win that event, of course. After he finished playing, Tom Weisskopf became somewhat of a noted golf course architect, design credits from around the world. He was a true ambassador of the game. As Vito pointed out the other day, a beautiful swing, or just a genuinely good guy. Sunday, we lost former Russian soldier and actor Nikolai Lebedev. You've probably never seen him or heard of him, but he made it to 100 years old, so props to him for that, as well as for playing former American general and president Dwight D. Eisenhower in a 1985 film that you've also never seen or heard of. Monday, we lost former New Zealand and Aussie singer Margaret Ehrlich. She was, 57, a two-year battle with cancer. She hit solo success down under, as they say, in 1989. She went on to do songs and albums with other noted artists, Crowded House, Split Enz, Neil, and Tim Finn. Okay, the irony there is the Finn brothers were members of those bands and the founding members. So anyway, sad loss. We also lost Gary Gaines. Gary Gaines was a former football coach. He was 73, complications of Alzheimer's. He made fame with the publication of the book Friday Night Lights, A Town, A Team, and A Dream. That book chronicled the 1988 football season of the Permian Panthers high school team in Odessa, Texas. Follows the developments of the season, really. They lose a star running back to a knee injury. Quarterback has a rough family life. And then they get a coin flip. They have to do a coin flip to get into the playoffs. And they eventually reach the state championship, believe it or not, before they lose to a real powerhouse team of the time, Carter High School from Dallas. It was made into a feature film in 2004 with Billy Bob Thornton playing the role of Gary Gaines. And then later became a TV series. Now, Gary Gaines led Permian to the state title the following season. They finished with a 16-0 record. He left Permian after that season, moved on to college coaching, which included a head coaching stint at Abilene Christian. By the way, if anyone can give me what might be the most famous but little-known bit of trivia about Abilene Christian football, that would be cool. We'll see. On Monday, we also lost Jerry Allison, best known as the drummer for the Crickets. Yeah, as in Buddy Holly and the Crickets. He also wrote or co-wrote two of their better-known songs, Peggy Sue and That'll Be the Day. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame back in 2012. Yesterday, we lost Russian theoretical physicist Lev Padaevsky at age 89. He was noted for the Gross-Padaevsky equation, which describes the ground state of a quantum system of identical bosons using the Hartree-Fock approximation and the pseudo-potential interaction model. That takes care of that, doesn't it? Okay, and then today, found out former footballer and quarterback and broadcaster Len Dawson passed away. He was 87. Played his college ball at Purdue, where he, of course, haunted the Hawkeyes for a couple of those years. Won a Super Bowl with the Chiefs. Went on to a broadcast career, a long broadcast career, including pregame shows, inside the NFL, doing games. I mean, he pretty much did it all. He was actually served as a sports director for a Kansas City TV station, and he was a color analyst for the Chiefs radio network as well. Played, 15 seasons with the Pittsburgh Steelers, believe it or not, the Cleveland Browns, and then the Dallas Texans, who became the Kansas City Chiefs. He was the ninth of 11 children, and he was from grew up in Alliance, Ohio. Actually, his choice came down to Ohio State and Purdue. He said the real reason that he selected Purdue was the rapport that he had with assistant coach Hank Stram, who later coached him, of course, with the Chiefs. He was also reluctant to play in Woody Hayes' split T offense. 1954, he was the NCAA leader in pass efficiency. He also played defense, which they did back then, and served as the team's kicker. Yeah, they were a lot more versatile and all-around players back in the 50s, no doubt about that. But yeah, sad loss. Len Dawson, good man, good at his job, not just as a football player, but good as a broadcaster and color guy. So it's a sad loss. And moving on, hey, don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, your Central Florida 24-hour telephone messaging and call center, your medical clinic, your hospital clinic, your info gathering services, service companies. They do it all 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you are a remote worker, they like to utilize remote staff. So give them a call, 800-555-3738. It's 800-555-3738, which is one of those old school numbers, 800-555-3738. Or give them a look at alliancecommunications.com. And let's see, do we have any, we really don't have any quickies this week. In the second half of our show, of course, we're going to talk college football. Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk are going to be in for that. Got a quick internet laffy from the Babylon Bee where it says, a study finds 0% of leftists who are warning about overpopulation are willing to die first. I know, some of that stuff that cracks me up probably shouldn't crack me up, but hey, there's several ways to interact with us, by the way. You can come on in online, blogtalkradio.com, go into live, and then pick Global Patriot Radio down on the right-hand side in the chat, live chat. Or you can, of course, just listen online without doing anything. You can just listen. You can also call in. That's right, 319-527-6706. You do that, you can listen, but if you want to talk, you can hit the 1 on your phone, and before you know it, I get a little icon that says somebody wants to talk, and I take your call. Unless it's a nasty call, then I hang up on you, but let's hope it never gets to that. That was a good laughy, wasn't it? Study finds 0% of leftists who are warning about overpopulation are willing to die first. That's so perfect. Really is. Okay, let's get to our news, notes, idiocy, crap, and other interesting things. Okay, now, Dr. Fauci is now officially resigning from government service in December. In other words, if the GOP does indeed take back the House, he isn't going to stay around for the impending inquiries, investigations, and grilling in front of Congress, or so he thinks. Yeah, without a Democrat majority to prop him up and watch his back, he knows he could be in for some serious scrutiny. No doubt. He's been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief of NIAID's Laboratory of Immunoregulation. He also serves as Dopey Joe's chief medical advisor. Now, yeah, let's just say he isn't succeeding much the last few years, although he certainly hasn't let that stop him from appearing all over TV and the internet and no doubt enjoying a certain level of financial success both in and out of government. Dopey Joe praised Fauci with this statement. Whether you've met him personally or not, he has touched all Americans' lives with his work. I extend my deepest thanks for his public service. The United States of America is stronger, more resilient, and healthier because of him. Okay, let's put that to the test. First of all, service. He has touched Americans' lives, no doubt about that, but public service, meh. I think it's been Fauci service. Okay, let's put it to the test. Is the USA stronger? Okay, the better question really might be, has the USA ever seen a faster reduction of its strength than it has since Fauci, Birx et al. led the manipulation and mismanagement of the COVID-19 pandemic? The answer is an emphatic no on both counts, really. As in, no, we are not stronger, at least not stronger since Fauci became a household name, and no, we have never seen a faster reduction of our strength than what we have experienced since November 3rd of 2020. Are we more resilient? Hardly. One need only look at Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere to see that conservatives are getting tired of the leftist progressive crap coming from D.C., although one could argue that Big Left is ever resilient in its resolve to crush the American spirit and subdue and abuse the American people, so let's call that a wash. Are we healthier? Let's score that one an emphatic no. Yeah, we have young athletes collapsing, many of whom got the jab. We have more kids dying now than during the previous decade. The opioid crisis isn't getting any better. The wars, if you will, on drugs, poverty, and homelessness are no closer to being won than when Big Left first declared said wars. Tent cities have become actual named neighborhoods in several of our West Coast locales, and questionable water and food safety is as prevalent as it's ever been. Now, does all of this fall at the feet of Dr. Fauci? Maybe not, but he certainly hasn't been the solution, especially during the COVID pandemic, so, yeah. Moving on. In a rather sad story, two Indiana State football players were among three students that were killed in a single car crash over the weekend. Two other players were injured. Evidently, the car crashed into a tree around 1:30 a.m. Sunday. It was on fire when first responders arrived, and the driver and two others were pronounced dead at the scene. It has since been reported that thunderstorms had sort of left the roadway covered with water. The students, according to one of the surviving passengers, had been drinking at a party at the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington, and they were returning to the Indiana State campus in Terre Haute. That's sad. I mean, you know, I talked about it with a couple other player deaths this summer. This is obviously very close to the season. These guys were probably going to be reporting to practice Monday. And now what, you know? And it's terrible when that happens. It just crushes a team. Really does. So Dopey Joe has, via executive order, given the forgiveness of student debt of up to $10,000 for people earning less than $125,000 a year, giving 20,000 Pell Grants. Dopey Joe is also extending the moratorium on student repayment for 4 months to December 31st of this year. According to a person familiar with the matter, this will be the last moratorium extension from Dopey Joe. This is now the seventh extension since the COVID pandemic. And of course, progressive liberal types want the income level raised as well as the cap level on forgivenesses. You know, because an individual or couple making more than $125,000 a year still can't manage student debt. Yeah, oddly enough, they can afford a Tesla, they can go to expensive restaurants, and they can hang out with celebrities. Yeah, oh, the conundrum. Okay, my take. This is obviously morphing into the AOC personal relief bill. She will continue to push as long as she is in office for this student loan debt forgiveness. I'm not sure why. Her $174,000 annual salary is apparently not cutting it. The poor gal probably lives in a rent-controlled domicile, gets freebies like nobody's business, and can't get a handle on basic economics. But yeah, we need to forgive her student loan debt. Number two, this isn't forgiveness in any way, shape, or form. As I've said before, and we'll reiterate now, this is money we borrowed via raising the national debt and bloating the Department of Education. In order to loan it to somebody to go to school. Theoretically, it's paid back by the borrowers. Now, number three, the debt is still owed. That money that we borrowed or added to our national debt for this program, that money is still owed, but now it's owed by us. Whether or not we took student loans, or more importantly, approved said loans. I mean, if I run a bank, I can choose whether or not to approve a loan, whether it's for a house or a business or a home equity line of credit or whatever. But in this case, I, as a taxpayer, borrowed this money in order to loan it to someone else. I had no say in who did or didn't get the loans. I had no option to investigate their creditworthiness, their field of study, or even their academic progress. I mean, for all I know, a good number of these people blew the money on things that had no connection to actual education. But again, either way, whether it was spent on education or not, I had no say in the matter. Now, in predictable fashion, each and every time student loan funds and increases of same are approved and allocated by our federal government, guess what? Yeah, the costs for tuition, fees, housing, and books also magically increases. In other words, as long as free money flows from us, the taxpayers, educational institutions have no reason to rein in costs of attendance, and of course, no reason to rein in costs of running their said institutions. Hence, while inflation numbers have done their thing, educational institutions have looked at inflation and collectively together and said, hold my beer. Five, there are tons of ways to get education funding, loans, scholarships, grants, whatever. But to my understanding, from a funding perspective, grants are just that, grants. They are not loans. They are not repaid. They are, in essence, gifts. So what the hell with forgiving Pell Grants become loans? And what are we forgiving and why? Well, not so simple. It actually means this. If you received a Pell Grant, i.e. a gift of free money, you are eligible not for $10,000 of student loan forgiveness, but $20,000 of student loan forgiveness. In other words, we are giving away Pell Grant money as taxpayers. And now we are also forgiving any student debt incurred by Pell Grant recipients. In other words, my friends, we are giving people money and then on top of that, loaning them money. What in the hell? But then we're telling them they don't have to pay it back. So now it gets really infuriating. 60% of the borrowers are affected. Yeah, you guessed it. Pell Grant recipients. In other words, you aren't on the hook for $10,000 times X. You're on the hook for $20,000 times 60% of X, plus $10,000 for 40% of X. Good God, I am not sure which alphabet agency needs to be obliterated first. Whether, I mean, really, Department of Education, FBI, IRS, Justice. I mean, seriously, the overhaul needed in our government really is starting to look insurmountable. It's frightening. Absolutely frightening. I mean, what in the... $330 billion with a stroke of a pen, an executive order, no congressional approval, certainly congressional input, but not from all congressional members, you can be sure. You can bet he didn't talk to, you know, normal congressional types. And the interesting thing is how many people in Congress have student loan debt? We don't really know. We know that several do, but we don't know exactly. I mean, there's no list that I know of. But the fact of the matter is, whether or not they voted on it or consulted on it, it's such a, I mean, it's a conflict of interest doesn't even begin to cover it. Doesn't even begin to cover it. Although that's probably the only way to say it. But I mean, seriously, AOC voting on something like that when she owes student loan debt, I mean, had it been before Congress, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have passed. Not by much. It might have stalled in the Senate even. But now with an executive order, now somebody's going to have to do something in terms of a suit. Because I am pretty sure the Supreme Court would say the president doesn't have this type of authority. Maybe wrong. I'll ask Mike about that later. He's going to be on later, of course, for our college football talk. But, I mean, think about this. Who controls the purse strings? Who controls the purse strings? Congress, theoretically. Congress sets in motion appropriations. Now, granted, the departments have certain budget items, et cetera, but something like this, this is $330 billion that our president has just obliterated with a stroke of a pen. And we're supposed to sit here and act like it's normal and whatever. Wrong. This is $330 billion that our Congress wouldn't be able to afford. But our president is saying, no biggie. I'll handle this. $330 billion. It's not so much that we've handed it out. It's that because we already handed it out. That's just it. We've already spent the money. Problem is, we were expecting, as we should have been, for that money to be paid back. Now, Alaskan in the chat room, Boyd, welcome, sir, in there with Indy. Theoretically, these people were going to be paying it back. As Boyd says, they call it that buying votes. That's exactly what it is. It's vote buying. Indy Hawk asks, how far back does the forgiveness go? And Alaskan points out, 1 year before you would get it, Indy. Yeah, exactly. It says up to $125,000. Now, I know money's not what it once was, especially in these inflationary times, but would you not think that somebody who makes $125,000 a year would be able to better budget to pay off student loan debt, number one? I mean, are we really talking about people that are probably have the big screen TVs and Teslas, like I said, or some other, Prius or whatever? I mean, that's just it. These people are going to these Met galas and these White House press corps galas and these other celebrity galas. And they're saying, let's forgive student debt. Or in some cases, they have student debt. I mean, seriously, if you can't figure out how to pay back $10,000 of debt, making, say, $75,000 a year, if you can't figure out how to pay $10,000 of student debt on $75,000 a year, other than the fact that you might be living in New York in the most expensive place and it doesn't have rent control, other than that, if you can't figure out how to pay back $10,000 in student debt, assuming here that you have a degree, so you have somewhat of a decent job. Now, we can make the argument that, all those people got worthless degrees. Why did we loan them the money? Why the hell did we? I mean, if you went to a bank and said, I've got a great business idea. What is it? Casino, but it's a casino where people bet on games that nobody cares about. We bet on Tiddlywinks and we bet on Parcheesi. Well, bankers aren't quite going to go all in on that. If you go and you say, I've got a great business idea. It's a bar. Oh, really? Yeah, I serve top shelf liquor for the cheapest prices. Well, a banker's not going to go for that. Of course not. I'm not saying banks are loaded with integrity, because they aren't. But at some point, I mean, if we're saying, well, they went and got degrees that aren't worth anything, why? Why did they do it, and why did we allow it? Why should I give somebody a loan to go major in general studies or gender studies, for that matter? Why the hell should I do that? Why should I be on the hook for that? Why should you be on the hook for that? But hey, since we're giving it away, you notice the schools aren't turning it down at all. Yeah, this is as irresponsible an executive order as we've had. I mean, we're arguing whether this is the worst president ever. We're not. It's not even worth debating, because it's not even close. Today, NFL linebacker Shaquem Griffin announced his retirement from the NFL as an active player, and that he will now work with the NFL Legends community. Yeah, Griffin's the guy, his twin brother. He and his twin brother, Shaquille, played their college ball at UCF and then for a couple seasons together with the Seattle Seahawks. Shaquem, I don't want to say became famous, but maybe inspirational. He was a fierce competitor despite the loss of a hand due to amniotic band syndrome. He had his hand removed at 4 years old. He was part of UCF's undefeated 2017 team that went on to beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl. Yeah, after which head coach Scott Frost declared his team national champs and then subsequently left UCF for his alma mater, Nebraska. By the way, he has sucked at Nebraska. Anyway, Kim Griffin leaves the NFL as a player, but also as a symbol of toughness, inspiration, and the fact that anything is possible with the right attitude, the strong work ethic, and support from family, friends, and teammates. So good career. He didn't want to bounce from team to team. He wanted to play with his brother, and he knew that was kind of unrealistic to say wherever he goes, I go, or vice versa. So a person I follow on Twitter, goes by the handle Brown Eyed Girl, made a remarkable observation the other day. And in the face of subsequent comments and events, it has me really wondering. Her tweet was simple. Said this: isn't it odd that Mike Pence is literally the only person in Trump's orbit that the FBI hasn't investigated? And why is that? It's a great question. Why hasn't he been investigated? And the bigger question, after he has said he would testify before the January 6th Inquisition and told people to lay off the FBI after the Mar-a-Lago raid, question is whether or not Pence was part of the whole process of making sure President Trump wasn't reelected. I mean, seriously, it's not like I can remember him actively campaigning in 2020. It's not like he has ever come forward with the accomplishments of the Trump administration pre-COVID, or whether or not the Trump administration was misled by people like Fauci or Birx during COVID. It's really a great question. How can a member of the administration be one of the very few not to face scrutiny? One other I can think of, by the way, Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao. Why do you think that's been the case? Could it be the fact that she is married to Mitch Bitch McConnell? Seriously, why hasn't Pence been questioned? Why has it never come up that Pence, I mean, other than the fact that he didn't take, you know, that he didn't stop the certification of the election or whatever, why has Pence not come up anywhere? I mean, the whole Trump administration was maligned, and yet somehow Pence has escaped any kind of scrutiny. How and why is that? Look, I don't want to take shots at the guy. I mean, in all honesty, why has Trump been facing all this scrutiny? But that's, you know, that's what we can expect. But why hasn't Pence faced it? Really is a good question. Another tweet, rather forceful one, came from Colorado U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert. Her tweet reads thusly: Fauci is stepping down in December to try and avoid scrutiny from a Republican House that will take over in January. Understand this loud and clear, Anthony. We are coming for you whether you retire or not. You will not get away with what you did to America. Now, one can argue whether a congresswoman or congressman should be going off like that on Twitter. When I say one can argue it, one might say, oh, that's not cool. First Amendment be damned, of course. But, I mean, yeah, I agree in a sense. I mean, God, don't play your hand. Number one. And number two, don't gloat. And number three, let it play out. You don't need to tweet it. But I think the sentiment's there. You know, a lot of people are saying Republicans are turning on this, Republicans are turning on that, and blah, blah. Not as much as you think. I mean, yeah, there are some that suck, but, you know, I think if Republicans take back the House, I'm pretty sure they will take back the House. They're talking about the Senate not being a given now, but if Republicans take back the House, yeah, I mean, now, yes, I do want to see investigations. I know there are people who said, I want to see arrests, and that's me. I don't want to see platitudes. I want to hear thoughts and prayers. I want to see people locked up. But, yeah, I want investigations. I want this on TV. I want real questions asked and answered. I want to see Fauci squirm. I want to hear, what we thought was best at the time. I want that bastard to squirm. You're damn right I do. Burks to squirm. I want Burks to say, if you knew that these vaccines were ineffective, why were you pushing them? I want people like Andrew Cuomo in front of a friggin' investigating. I want people like Gavin Newsom. I want people that told their state residents not to travel or not to do this or do that, and then they traveled and did this and did that. I want those people before Congress and whoever, wherever else they should be. Damn right. Everybody's saying, that's vindictive. We have to move forward. Here's what I say to those people. Fuck off. Serious. I'm that's how mad I've gotten. I've tried not to use that kind of language on this show. But seriously, fuck off. I'm tired of this crap. I am tired of student loans being forgiven. Tired of being told I got to wear a mask. Or that I got to be this, careful that. Or that I have to feel this and have to forgive that. I remember a woman I knew very well in a former church that I used to go to, my wife and I. It was right after 9/11, and we had our usual Wednesday night dinner. And then we had, you know, we usually break out into different discussion groups. But we decided, you know, our pastors decided we would just have a church service that night, you know, just a prayer service. I'll never forget this one woman. She was one of our Sunday school teachers for like our young adults. That's back when I was young. And she said, you know, she goes, oh, I just, and we were talking about, I don't know, I kind of dread this. We had a couple of our parish associates that were more liberal. And I kind of wondered whether our co-pastors would be wishy-washy or whatever. And I just remember her saying this. She says, look, I don't want to go out and kill everybody. I don't want to go out and kill anybody who's Muslim. That's not my point. She goes, I'm not ready to hear a sermon about forgiveness. I'm just not. Well, you know what? That was brilliant. Because it doesn't mean that you shouldn't work to forgive people or seek to forgive people. Point was, at that point, particular point, a sermon about forgiveness wasn't going to cut it. That's why I say, in a sense, when I hear we're going to have investigations, that's not going to cut it. I want to hear that you're going to have investigations that get to the bottom of it. I don't want Anthony Fauci to come before Congress, a Republican Congress, and be fed softballs. If I want that, I can watch a Nick Saban press conference. Do the job. Today's Creepy Award is ready for giving, and it goes to James Davidson, or maybe it's Haley Davidson. You see, it can't decide. Davidson, who competed as James Davidson until 2015, but has had gender reassignment surgery and hormone treatments, is now competing as Haley Davidson and trying to get a spot on the LPGA Tour. Davidson claims to be hitting the ball 15 miles per hour slower since last year's surgery. While many are against Davidson's competing, she actually has the support of World Golf Hall of Fame member Laura Davies, by the way, who wasn't exactly the most feminine member in the history of the tour. The LPGA removed its female by birth policy in 2010. Now, Davidson claims that it isn't about protecting women's sports, but simply about transphobia. I'll counter with this. It is about protecting women's sports. That's why many women don't want people like you participating in women's sports. It ain't rocket science. In fact, we could ask that Russian scientist I talked about in the obits, but he's obviously dead, which is why I talked about him in the obits. But man, the Soviets were masters at pretending some of their athletes were quote-unquote female. In fact, several of their former Olympic champions had to leave women's sports when they decided to take the rational step of conducting chromosome tests. So here goes the award to James Haley It Davidson. I play you this clip from Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Perfect right to play a part in our movement, Reg. Why are you always on about women, Stan?
I want to be one.
What?
I want to be a woman.
From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.
What?
It's my right as a man.
Well, why do you want to be Loretta, Stan?
I want to have babies.
Do you want to have babies?
It's every man's right to have babies if he wants them.
But you can't have babies!
Don't you oppress me.
I'm not oppressing you, Stan. You haven't got a womb. Where's the fetus going to gestate? You're going to keep it in a box?
Here, I've got an idea. Suppose you agree that he can't actually have babies, not having a womb, which is nobody's fault, not even the Romans, but that he can have the right to have babies.
Good idea, Judith. We shall fight the oppressors for your right to have babies, brother. Sister, sorry.
What's the point?
What?
What's the point of fighting for his right to have babies when he can't have babies?
It is symbolic of our struggle against oppression.
Symbolic of his struggle against reality.
That says it all, that last one. His struggle against reality. That's what we have here, folks. We have someone who's clearly lost his or her, or his and her, grip on reality. Now, here's the thing. We talked about this on Vito's show the other night because I called in when they were talking about it. Why is the LPGA putting up with this? Why did they even think something like that was a good idea? Who knows? But the PGA, of course, is going to have to go along with it. So this wokeness brigade, which has hit too many sports now, is rearing its ugly head. Now, this person supposedly is in 59th place of the 310 people trying to get a spot on the tour. And if you hit like three rounds of 88 or better, you can, I don't know, whatever. So, I mean, I'm not going to wear a skirt. I am going to wear a skort maybe. And I'm going to try if I can get my game down to 88. I'm going to call myself a woman. And I have the right to try for the LPGA Tour. I mean, look at it this way. Maybe hitting the ball, driving the ball 15 miles per hour slower, but it's also teeing off about 30 yards ahead of where it was teeing off. So, you know, that's a trade-off, I guess. You know, it's insanity, people. It's a mental disease. Equity, equality, fairness, competition. It's a mental disease. And now to the raid at Mar-a-Lago. Really brief, but according to a memo reported on by Fox News' Sean Hannity, the White House was informed of the raid on Mar-a-Lago, which of course directly conflicts with statements from Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and others. This isn't shocking, of course. I mean, Attorney General Merrick Garland and FBI Director Christopher Wray both lied and said they weren't part of it either. Like I said, the alphabet agencies that are destroying this country really do. Country's troubles are insurmountable. Really makes it look like that. Finally, Liz Cheney, the deposed Wyoming Republican congresswoman. First, she had her father campaign for her. The gist of his message had nothing to do with Liz Cheney, of course, and everything to do with President Trump. Liz Cheney, during her campaign, rarely talked about her record and mainly talked about President Trump. Now, Liz Cheney has, quote, vowed, unquote, to campaign against anyone who has supported President Trump's questioning of the validity of the 2020 election. She's also, quote, vowed, unquote, to do everything in her power to make sure President Trump never again occupies the White House. Now, folks, I'm preaching to the choir in a sense, but this is what's called an unhealthy obsession. Now, in the case of her father, who I once respected greatly, I say this, dude, sunset. As in, get back on that horse and take your ass off into the sunset. You've been irrelevant for 14 years. You've become the poster child for hypocrisy, and you still couldn't pay me enough to hunt with you, no matter how primo the land or primo the game harvesting opportunities. Pheasant, dove, duck, whatever, I wouldn't hunt with you. You forget big game hunting requiring a rifle. No thanks. I'd rather hunt with Bobby Knight or take a drive with one of the Kennedy clan. But Liz, seriously, the gig is up. You've shown your obsession. Now, look, while I don't believe you to be a fake conservative, I do believe you to be an uber-obsessed never-Trumper who has jumped the shark irrationality and obsession. But worse, you can't even address your husband's connection via his law firm to the whole Hunter Biden mess. Besides the not-so-good look of being an obsessed never-Trumper, you're also showing yourself to be a part of the deep state swamp apparatus. I mean, seriously, you now appear basically as some bratty, petulant 12-year-old who hasn't gotten her way. And rather than the obligatory tantrum followed by the walk-off back home, you're staying on the football field after getting the targeting penalty. You won't leave the field, and now you're determined to see that the player you targeted won't play another down, catch another pass, or score another touchdown. Literally, you've jumped the shark. But now you're trying to drown the damn thing. I mean, for those who know what that reference is, this is what I say. Take off the skis, give Fonzie back his leather jacket, and go the hell home. Oh, yeah, and if things keep going a certain way, you might want to hire a lawyer. Either way, have some class. Lose with dignity. It cheapens all of us when you act like Hillary Clinton did in 2016. Look, I'm conjuring up images of Amy Madigan. Remember when she was at the Oscars? Elia Kazan, who had been accused of turning people over to the blacklist. Remember, anyway, he was getting a lifetime award, and Amy Madigan just sat there glaring the whole time. It's like somebody pointed out, a liberal person pointed out, what did Elia Kazan ever do to Amy Madigan? So Liz Cheney, just stop already. You're embarrassing yourself. You're embarrassing your state. You're embarrassing my country. End of story on that. Here's another internet laughy on Twitter from UnvaxedBitch85, which says, I've had sex that was more destructive than January 6th. Yeah, sometimes people come up with the good stuff, don't they? They really do. But in this case, probably true. I just am so beyond some of this stuff. Nikki and Liz Cheney, I mean, it's just. We're going to take a quick break. I want to thank those for being here, Alaskan Boyd, the Alaskan, and Indie Hawk KB sitting in the chat room. My big sister and Hawkeye Mike and Sue from New Mexico and two numbers I don't recognize sitting in the phone area. And then I'm going to take a break. Going to be back with Indie Hawk and Hawkeye Mike. We are going to talk some college football. Believe it or not, the season gets underway this weekend in limited fashion and then really takes off next week. So we're going to talk about it. In the meantime, do this. Enjoy the music.
My, what a marvelous time. Wear your ties and leather shoes. You gotta win and never lose. Oh, and why, oh, why? Oh, Jack, I cry. If it happens to you today. Why such a glorious guy? Easy friends are easy foe. Ooh, you never know. Oh, and my, oh, my. Oh, Jack, you'll die. We'll be right back.
Sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith.
Oh, he got it! Smith ducks down 85 yards! Iowa! C.J. Beathard!
Oh, that was a glorious night. That certainly was. It didn't end well, but that play was something else. Hey, I've got Indy Hawk on the phone and Hawkeye Mike on the phone. How you guys doing?
Doing well, Hank.
How really good, eh?
All right. Well, you know, if not, if that doesn't get you in the mood, I don't know what would as a Hawkeye fan. But, you know, hey, you know, it's just
I never forget that play.
I know.
That Monty Python click was spot on, Hank. You've helped me kind of understand what's going on.
I mean, here's the thing. That movie came out in 1979. Who would have thought that, you know, 40-some years later, that's the kind of – that's creeping into our mainstream thought. I mean, it's just – it's frightening. It really is. So let's get right to the Big Ten East. The consensus pick, no surprise, seems to be Ohio State with, you know, the occasional person thinking Michigan or Penn State or MSU might get to the top. But, Andy, what are your thoughts? Am I the only one that sees just how much and who Michigan has lost? What's your thought?
Yeah, I think it's Ohio State. They're loaded. Michigan, I believe they have a new offensive and defensive coordinator.
Yep.
So that'll be interesting to see how they adapt to that. Ohio State has a new defensive coordinator from Oklahoma State, I believe, which is, you know, that guy knows his stuff. So that'll be really interesting. But I look for Ohio State to, you know, come out of there.
How badly do you want Penn State to beat Purdue next week?
That would be nice.
I second that.
Yeah. Who in the Indy? Who do you see in the Big Ten East? Do you think there's any undervalued teams? Like there's a team that's not on the radar that might be better?
Yeah, I actually don't. I think it's Michigan and Ohio State, and if you know, I'm holding out hope that we keep the divisions, because otherwise I think we're heading for back-to-back Michigan-Ohio State games because they play the last week of the regular season. Then they'll play in the conference championship. But I don't know. I think those two teams are probably clearly the best in that division.
Yeah. Okay. Mike, what do you think? Do you think anybody has a legitimate chance at Ohio State?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't remember now. Is Sean Clifford back at Penn State?
He is.
Okay, I thought maybe that was the case. You know, Penn State with Clifford showed some spark last year, but they were kind of fizzled. But I think the team that was a kind of surprise last year that was really pretty solid was Michigan State. So we'll see if they keep making progress. But I agree with Andy Hawk that I think Michigan and Ohio State are the cream of that crop. But I do kind of wonder that about Michigan. They had some big losses on defense in particular. So I don't think they're going to be quite at the level. I could be wrong. I don't think they're going to be quite at the level they were at last year. And that game against Ohio State's in Columbus this year, so just like Iowa's game. But I think the game, the trap game to watch, is my prediction, is I think it's about the first day of October maybe. Michigan comes into Kinnick Stadium, and I think Iowa maybe, you know, looking at a little payback.
Yeah, oh, no doubt, no doubt. You know what I'm surprised about, and Mike, your thoughts maybe, it seems like Indiana and Rutgers, I mean, you know, Schiano, I think, is a proven guy, and Indiana certainly had a year there of greatness, but, that, you know, consensus seems to be really down on them. I just don't get it. I mean, I thought everybody thought Rutgers was making a good hire with Schiano, and I agree, but nobody seems to agree. Or you got any thoughts on that?
I think, you know, I thought Schiano did a good job last year after coming back to coach, considering the depth to which Rutgers had sunk. And I think they were 5-7 last year and showed some life a little in a few games. So I don't know. They're predicting them to take a step back. I haven't really followed Rutgers that closely, but I mean, I think that last year was a hopeful year for them, and at least they were competitive in a number of games. And I was a little nervous that game Iowa plays them in. Piscataway?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, any road game, you know, you can be a little concerned about it. I don't think Iowa will have a problem, but you never know. But I think that I felt like they were on the way up, but I don't know if they're predicting them to take a step back this year. Not sure why.
What?
Yeah.
Would
no,
you
that's
say,
true. That's true.
I what did you say?
They've struggled on offense. They've struggled on offense.
But,
their defense is pretty
good.
But
I think they. Yeah, they went from 1-5 wins. I think they had one win 2 years ago.
And I'm wondering if that's what I wonder if Indiana just benefited from a COVID type of year because, you know, like Rutgers should have. I thought Rutgers a couple of years ago would be great because they got all their COVID stuff out of the way earlier. But Indiana, like, they just fell off the face of it last year. Indy, you live there. What's the general thought on Indiana? Is it just Tom Allen's not the wunderkind or?
Yeah, they've just taken a step back. There hasn't been a lot of excitement. There was a lot of excitement when he came in, but then it's just not much right now. There's not a lot of momentum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they had that big year in 2020. You know, I mean, they beat Penn State in dramatic fashion. They stayed with Ohio State, but they just basically didn't get it done in the bowl game. That was probably the. I mean, I was shocked when the way Iowa beat them last year, frankly. So, and I don't know if you guys saw Penix, their quarterback is now has been named the starting quarterback at Washington. Do you guys see that?
I did not
Michael
hear
Penix.
That.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, he went into the portal, of course. Like, who didn't go in the portal? And he's been named the starting quarterback. So, you know, of course, he's going to get injured in Game 7, probably. But, you know, I just thought that was interesting that, you know, he's good enough to go out there to Washington and get the starting quarterback job. So, you know,
he'll be back in the Big Ten in a year.
No, this is it. This is really his last year.
Oh,
I think COVID and all, I think it's his last year for sure. So, okay, let's pivot a bit. Did either of you watch the Charlie Jones interview that he had?
I did not.
Yeah, I did.
I did not see
it. Yeah. Andy, what was your general impression?
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead. You want to say something?
No, are you talking about? Because I did read something. Is this where he? And then I'll defer to India. Is this where he was basically saying that he transferred because he didn't think that Iowa was going to throw the ball very much?
Well, I didn't see it as that. Go ahead, Indy.
He did. Well, he's reported to have said that. So I don't know if he said it in the interview or not.
Yeah,
not in this interview.
You know, I watched the interview, and he basically said, you know, I came for the offense. And he said, I came for the offense. Pretty simple, the system. Kind of a knock on Iowa, but I kind of took him at his word. He grew up with the quarterback. They grew up together, playing together since third grade. And then he keeps in touch with Tyron Tracy. I also saw an interview with Reganey, the Iowa wide receiver. You know, they're good buds too, but, you know, Tyron Tracy came back. It sounds like it's good terms, but I know he went to spring ball, and he transferred actually after spring ball, which I didn't recall that. So I think Charlie Jones.
Yeah, he went through spring ball.
Right. I think he saw, you know, we're pretty loaded at wide receiver with young guys. I think he probably saw, you know what, you know, I'm not going to be the guy. And he did talk a lot about the passing game. I know I'm a returner, but I can do things in the passing game, and these guys are going to, you know, focus on that for me, showcase me as a receiver.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, Purdue lost their number one guy to academic stuff, and that was like on May 14th, and then on May 17th, I think it was, or maybe it was later than that even, that Jones then decided that he announced that he was going to make the move. I think there was tampering going on. I mean, they used that quarterback as an example, you know, that he was close to him. He hadn't played with him. He literally hadn't played with him since like fourth grade. He didn't play with him through middle school. He didn't play with him through high school. So that to me is a crock. And yes, Tyron Tracy did go back for the spring game. I mean, I think Tyron Tracy was on good terms. You know, I think he did it right. If there's a right way to do it, he did it back, you know, in before the bowl game, even, I think. And, you know, so what did Reganey have to say? What was Reganey's thought?
Well, they're still buds. They're, you know, Tyron Tracy keeps in touch with him. He's really close with Charlie Jones still. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I'm a little bit leery of the wide receivers leaving Iowa to go to Purdue. Maybe
two of them.
David Bell averaging 400 yards a game against Iowa. Maybe that's having a bigger impact.
Yeah. I was going to have to tighten up on defense against them. Purdue seems to have had their number, and which is rare because the defense for Iowa has, you know, been our strength.
Yeah, just not against Purdue. I mean, I think they threw that three quarterback wrinkle at us that killed us. David Bell always killed. I think our defense, our defenders know how to cover Charlie Jones because they've done it, you know, all through practice, all through their career. So that part doesn't, you know. I just thought he was arrogant, ungrateful. He didn't say any, you know. I mean, you know, look, he didn't owe it to say anything to Iowa, but you know, if he was such buddies with this guy from Purdue, why didn't he go to Purdue straight from Buffalo? You know. Why didn't he? And why wasn't he asked that? I mean, I think the way Kirk Ferentz has responded about some of the NIL and transfer portal stuff, I think that says it all. He didn't say anything. He didn't mention Charlie Jones. He's got too much class to do that. But I think as much as the players might still get along and everything, I think there are guys that are going to be resentful of him, and I think they should be. I mean, I'm sorry, the way he did it, I thought was wrong, and I hope, like I said to somebody, blows out a knee in the first week against Penn State, I'm not going to feel sorry for him. Look, I don't want it to happen to him, but you know, I think it sucked. That's just me. So, he is supposedly though going to start there, right?
I don't know. He didn't really say that. I assume so.
He roomed
with McConnell, and they went through the playbook every day during the summer. And I think he got married, so he got kicked out. But
so I have a question for Indy Hawk real quick. That game is at West Lafayette. Any chance you might be going?
Oh, no, I haven't looked at it. But the Indy Hawk Bed and Breakfast is available, so if you guys want to come down, we can make the
I can't imagine that West Lafayette's a hard ticket, but I could be totally wrong on that. So,
I've been there a while ago.
Not too far away, is it? Yeah, it's a little north.
About
guess, right?
90 but, minutes but, for me.
Okay.
90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been through West Lafayette. I've never asked one stadium, a Big Ten stadium I've not been in. But West Lafayette is not, you know, it's I suppose it's a step up from Champaign or Urbana, but, you know, what's not? What's not a step up from Champaign or Urbana, but, you know, so I don't know. You know, it's just – so let's look at the first half schedule for the Hawks. It includes two of the Big East teams, so we just talked about that. So there's some – you know, looking at that schedule, there's some – you know, South Dakota State is, you know, ranked in FCS. They made their FCS finals, I think, two seasons ago. You know, and that's, you know, it's in a sense, it's reminiscent of, to me, North Dakota State when they came in and beat us, you know, that kind of scares me. What are your thoughts? I mean, you know, one, do you think we're going to win it? And two, what do you think we should be looking for that game that'll tell us about the season?
I don't understand why we do that. I mean, if you're going to schedule an FCS team, why would you, you know, these guys are, they're good. They're number two in the preseason, and you know,
well, they're number two.
State, they beat us. Yeah. These guys are. Yeah. I mean, this will be a really tight game. I mean, remember last year, Alabama played Citadel. You know, same thing, tied at half, and Alabama blew them out. But I don't. Yeah, when you're scheduling an FCS opponent, you're not going to get any respect for it. So why schedule a good one? I don't understand it, but. I think that's going to be a very, very tough game, especially with Iowa. Always start slow. I never understood that, but I hope I'm wrong on that.
They didn't start slow last year, but that you're right. They usually do. Look at the year before where they lost their first two games. So,
well, yeah. I think back though to 2015 when we played Illinois State, who was also supposedly good at that time, and had Trey Roberson at quarterback. And we actually looked really good then, you know. That's not the norm. I realize, but I mean, Indy, what would you want to see that would leave you thinking, okay, the Hawks are going to have a good season, and this is a good team. What would you want to see? What would you not want to see?
I think we're really loaded on defense. I mean, Jack Campbell, that guy is a stud. I mean, he's a huge linebacker. Uh-huh. You know, we got a lot of, you know, Riley Moss is back. The defense is loaded. I think the key is, you know, Petras has to be better. Hopefully he will be. He went to the Peyton Manning camp, so whatever that's worth. But 55%, that is not going to cut it. With, you know, with Iowa's offense, it's, you're going to be in a lot of third and shorts. You got to pick them up. That's, you got to get that 3 yard out or whatever, and can move the chains. But he has not been able to do that. But you know, he's going to be the guy, it looks like. So,
and Mike, what are you thinking? What do you not want to see that would have you think, you know, make you come away from that saying, I think this is going to be a decent season, a good season, or whatever?
Yeah, well, I agree with Indy Hawk. That South Dakota State game has me scared. I think they're going to, Iowa could have their hands full. But if Iowa is a solid team, which we won't know yet, then they should be able to handle South Dakota State. But the thing I want to see is, and what I'm hopeful of, is that even though we lost the consensus All-American Linderbaum, as a whole, the offensive line is going to be improved. And that's important for two reasons, to establish the run.
Yep.
And, you know, when you have sort of mediocre quarterbacks like with Petras and, you know, particularly, he needs the line to give him time, you know.
Yeah.
If he can get some, he'll be more effective. If you remember in 2020, after the first couple losses when Iowa really, and I, by the way, I think that was an underrated Iowa team. I think the offense there was really rolling by the end of the year. It was just
yeah, they were.
Kind of a weird year. But Petras looked better because he had a better offensive line, and he had time to throw it, and he had some good receivers with Smith Marset in particular just being outstanding. But I think that if he can get more time, if he can get better protection,
he can be a more effective quarterback. It's when he gets pressure, he just wilts. And, you know, we'll see. Maybe like Indy Hawk says, maybe the time with the Manning brothers helped him. But I do think Kurt's going to go with him as the starter in the first game. And we'll see what happens, you know. Go ahead.
I look back at that North Dakota State game, 2016, when we lost.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an upset. That's one thing I would look for is are we beating them? We had 34 yards rushing, time of possession, 36-23, them. This is an FCS team. I mean, that is going to be a really bad time.
Yeah, it is.
And you always do worry about Iowa the first game or two just being a little bit rusty, a little bit sluggish, and that's what makes these first game of the year games so unpredictable.
Yeah,
I think the game I would keep my eye on for a mild upset because I'm not sure how good Illinois is, but this Saturday they play Wyoming and they could have a tough time, you know.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll get to that. You guys both mentioned the line. I think that's really crucial. And I think evidence of the fact that the line just wasn't that good, you're seeing what Tyler Goodson's doing now in Green Bay, you know. And there's no doubt, I mean, people that said he danced too much or whatever, there's no doubt Tyler Goodson was a fantastic running back, and his potential was pretty much limitless, but he was simply hamstrung last year. He just simply did not have the holes. That he got 1,100 yards is kind of, in a sense, kind of surprising now in retrospect. So I think that's what we're looking for. I mean, our defense is going to be good as usual. Where I sometimes worry is that we don't always do well against mobile quarterbacks. Or innovative offensive coordinators, even, you know. I mean, that's kind of a problem. So, you know, maybe that's what to look for. But I think it really starts with our line. If our line is effective, if our line is solid, then I think that's where I'll come away saying at least this season's not going to be a total loss. So that's what I kind of like to see.
That's probably the biggest question is, what was that with the offensive line? I mean, my gosh, we had one of the best centers in the last couple decades in college football.
But there was nothing else there. But there was really nothing else other than him.
But that's who we have back.
Like. Right.
Yeah, that's who we have back.
I mean, I think there's some feeling that they did improve a little bit over the year. We saw in the bowl game, even though it was a loss, a better running game. If you remember, I think it was Gavin Williams went over 100 yards, and Iowa had some pretty – against Kentucky.
Yep.
And I think if you look at the line play in that game overall and compare it to, say, midseason or beginning, it was better. And so I think there's a view that as a whole, I also read that the starters are up, I think, averaging somewhere in the vicinity of 310. They've put on an average of about 15 pounds from last year. So I think there's some hope that the O-line as a whole unit will be better this year. We'll see.
Well, for the second time, Kirk went across the line of scrimmage and pulled in the defensive lineman. It worked very well for
right.
him,
obviously. Right.
But Logan Jones, who's a really good defensive lineman, he's now the center. So they've converted.
You mean Logan
Lee? Like
Logan Lee, is it? Is it Logan Lee?
No, Logan Lee's still on defense, I think. Logan Jones.
Oh, so
I think
it's
Logan
Jones.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
really good about the defensive. On the defensive line, I think they feel like they got a lot of depth, and that even though they lost Van Valkenburg, that they're going to be in pretty good shape there. Plus, with you've got three linebackers with on the Buckets watch list. Campbell's outstanding consensus preseason All American, along with Moss, but then with Justin Jacobs and Seth Benson. They're also on the Buckets watch list. I mean, when's the last time Iowa had three linebackers, or anybody really had all three linebackers on the watch list? And replacing Dane Belton is really going to be a key, I think. But I think that Xavier Nwankwo could be playing a lot pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the other thing, is that we are starting to get better athletes. You know, I mean, we've had good athletes in the past, don't get me wrong, but I think we are just starting to maybe, you know, getting the Caden Proctors, you know, that kind of thing. I think we're starting to pull in some of these guys, you know. Piersbacher left us years ago, and I think that kind of stuff is starting to be a thing of the past. And so I think that's a help. I think, in spite of the fact that there's that lawsuit, I think that the stigma is sort of been erased, you know. So I think that, you know, you have that, and I just you know, that part of it, I think I feel better about. I can't help but think that the line is going to be improved even without Linderbaum. You know, Linderbaum can't do it all by himself, you know. So if three of the four or three or four of them improve with any degree, and that's the way we're going to see Spencer Petras. I mean, if the line's not improved, then Spencer Petras is not going to be improved, because one,
right,
it's not so much
that
he needs
right
the time. It's really what we need. Iowa doesn't run. Iowa's not a pass first team. Iowa doesn't pass to set up the run.
Right.
Iowa runs to set up the play action pass. I mean,
right.
Regaining,
and that's all good Iowa teams. That's what they do. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, but CJ Beathard, great as he was at extending plays with his feet, CJ Beathard thrived off of play action. That clip I played with, you know, Tevon Smith, several passes throughout his career. I mean, it was play action that really, that's made our best quarterbacks, you know. So, I mean, Drew Tate didn't have that benefit in 2004, but for the most part, our best quarterbacks have been able to thrive with a play-action environment. So if we don't have the line to get a good run game going, then it doesn't really matter whether our quarterback is mobile or accurate or whatever, because he's not going to have time to do anything. So,
absolutely.
Okay, let's get to the Iowa State game. Mike, we'll start off with you, since you are a homegrown, you both were homegrown, but I mean, Mike, you went to Iowa State games as a kid. I mean, your brother is an Iowa State fan in spite of being an Iowa alum. What's your thoughts on that game?
If you'd asked me at the beginning of the year, I really thought Iowa was going to have a tough time and be a real underdog in that game in Ames last year. And so, you know, obviously pleasantly surprised by what happened. Iowa State was overhyped and really had a disappointing season, and they've lost a ton of people. It's absolutely a rebuilding year for Iowa State. And however, I would say this: they might surprise the other way this year, but I do not see Iowa losing to this Iowa State team that is going to be depleted quite a bit from last year in Kinnick Stadium.
Yeah, agreed. And frankly, we've had to play two games in a row at Jack Trice because of the COVID year where we didn't play.
Right,
but
right.
You were there for the 2019 game where we pretty much, you know, had, I mean, that's another glorious play that I watched.
The 7-hour game. Yeah.
No, yeah, but the punt return that where the Iowa State guy pushed his own.
Yeah.
I mean, that was glorious to see. You know, that's the game where you guys know me. You know my drinking history, so to speak. I was at that game. I got to the game. I think it was a 3:30 game. I was there. I was just drinking beers at the sports pub with, you know, with friends. And then my wife showed up later, and she was a good sport about it. And I wasn't even that ripped, really. But it was like at the end, it was like, you know, at 11 o'clock or whatever it was, it's like, let's do celebratory shots. And I was like, I need – and they're all doing like fireballs. I said, I need your crappiest, nastiest, cheapest bourbon. And they're all looking at me like, what the hell? Why? I said, because the last thing I need right now is to shoot something down really quick. I mean, I probably need, you know, Pepto-Bismol or something. I wasn't that even drunk, really. It's just, and I was literally slow drinking for 7 hours. I thought it was the
Yanglings that were sustaining you through most of that.
It was, but I mean, but
most
I think,
that,
you know,
that
at
game.
A certain point, you know, there's a mix that goes into your gut acid, and it's like there aren't enough chicken wings to soak it up. I mean, it was just like, holy crap. I mean, literally,
I just remember spending like about half that 8-hour period, about 3 or 4 hours, with 50,000 other people huddled underneath the bleachers.
Yeah.
Weren't people doing like slides onto the? I don't know if it was on the field, but like slides.
It was quite. The thing that was the most striking about that game, having been there, I hadn't been to an Iowa game for a while. I hadn't been in Ames at Jack Trice for who knows how long. But at the beginning of that game, the atmosphere, and this was in 2019, was Iowa State's going to win.
Yeah.
And the crowd was that way. The fans were – I mean, I have to tell you that you know, we've been through – we all remember the Iowa State games when we were in college and some since then. The hostility of these Iowa State fans.
ESPN game
Iowa
day was there too,
actually,
right?
We had some I remember some college kids that were, it was kind of funny. They were sitting near us and they were just acting obnoxious most of the game. Iowa State, remember, was ahead most of the game. And then slowly in the second half, Iowa just started taking over. Remember with Nate Stanley doing like the 10-yard quarterback sneaks?
Yep.
And you could just see they're just – Iowa finally figured out to just wear these guys down. And that's
your
how they came back
play
to the game. Right. And all of a sudden, it in that fourth quarter, it just got quiet as a rock. And it was – and it cleared out.
Yeah.
And when the game ended, it was like a funeral there, and except for me and a few others, we're having a, you know, really. I mean, I didn't carry on or anything, but it was just, you know, smiles. Let's put it that way, and thankfulness to get out of there with the W. But
yeah.
If you remember in that game, there was a big controversy where the Iowa band was got hassled quite badly. It became an incident that was kind of statewide scandal, you know,
yeah,
with the way these people were acting. And I think there was finally an apology that got issued by the Iowa State Athletic for that. But it was bad. I mean, it was, I don't know. I didn't hear that happened last year in Ames. I'm sure it was a bad atmosphere and disappointing, but I didn't hear that kind of an atmosphere. But I'll just tell you, boy, I have to say that the Iowa State fan base, they really have a little brother syndrome going, and it's probably because they've lost, what, they haven't won since 2014, and they've lost like 9 out of the last 10.
Yeah.
So, but that was quite an experience at that game.
The only time I went to Ames for the game, I didn't actually go in the stadium. You guys did, but a couple of us.
Oh, I remember.
BC and Doc and your buddy Don and I went to this bar called the Library, I think it was, or maybe it was the Hallway. Yeah, there was a bar named.
No,
the
we were down. We went to the Iowa State Union, and there was this.
Well,
band
that was
there.
You said something
about it. I wonder if you could get a chant going if someone started yelling blind faith.
Yeah, but that wasn't that time. That was a different time.
It happened.
Yeah, but that was a spring.
Yeah.
That
oh,
was
okay.
a spring
that
visit.
Was,
no, you
was,
were you were you were at this game.
Oh, okay.
Remember you
I
went to
at
the game.
Game.
Yeah, and the rest of us hung out at a bar called the Hallway at some mall, and you know we had lost 3 in a row at that point. We'd lost 80, 81, and 82, and then in 83 we absolutely destroyed them, and that was when that's what started the 15-year streak. So I just remember, you know, at that time, the bar atmosphere for there were Iowa State fans there, and it was quiet by the middle of the first quarter. I mean, it was just like, you know. And then last year, seeing them, you know, pull Purdy early, you know, in the late third quarter, and then they showed people leaving the
interception. Yeah,
yeah, but they showed people leaving the stadium by the end of the third quarter. I mean, that's really you know, that's when that's happening. Andy, we didn't leave Gims in the third quarter, did we? In Iowa
That's
City?
Me.
Yeah.
Nope.
Elmer. I don't remember ever doing that.
Andy, what's your thoughts on the Iowa State whole dig? You think? I mean, first of all, you think we have any shot of losing that game?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Matt Campbell. I think he's a great coach, but. Yeah, we should win it, but if we, you know, if we lose the turnover battle, you know, which we typically don't, but I gotta believe Kirk will have him ready, and that will win, especially at home.
Yeah, you realize since that the last turnover we had in the series that Iowa had turned the ball over was in the fourth quarter of the game in 2015. Jordan Canzari, we were driving. We were tied. Jordan Canzari running. He fumbled. We held
right.
them. They punted, and then Desmond King had that return out to like the 50. And then a couple plays later, Beathard threw that absolute rope to McCarron in the end zone, and then we later got an interception and another touchdown. But that's 2015 was the last time we had a turnover against Iowa State. Yeah, when that happens, your prospects of winning are pretty good.
Yeah, that's Kirk.
So, yeah. Okay, so Nevada, or do we even talk about this game? Is there even anything to talk about with Nevada? I mean, do we know anything about Nevada? Anybody know anything?
If this was last year's team, it would be a scarier game. If you're in Norvell now has left and gone to Colorado State, so Norvell would have had an incentive. But I think he's a good coach, and they had a pretty good team last year, but I think they've lost a lot of people. By the way, South Dakota State would really be scary if it was last year's team. I believe they had a really good quarterback. I can't remember his name, but he's gone, so they're going to be a little bit rebuilding themselves, but still good. But I think, yeah, Nevada probably, last year's Nevada team would have been a real challenge, maybe not quite as much this year.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to our first look at Joey Labus.
yeah, there you go.
Okay.
See what we got.
On to Rutgers. Indy, you're closer to Rutgers than any of us. Well, maybe not, but I think you are. Would you make the trip to New Jersey to see Iowa play football?
That's a long ways.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be one of those ugly, ugly games.
I think it's the only reason I would go to New Jersey is to see Iowa play football.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Mike, you mentioned it. You mentioned it's a scary game. Go ahead, Andy.
I'll just say, any road game in the Big Ten scares me. Let's just put it that way. I've seen it enough where Iowa will lose to people they have no business losing to, particularly on the road.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
No, I think this is going to be one of those ugly games like, remember Penn State 6-4? I think this will be like 13-10 Iowa, ugly. Kirk's going to find a way to pull it out. But, yeah, we can lose these games. They're not easy. Especially, it all depends on can we run the ball? Is the offensive line back? Is Petrus back?
Right.
That's all. Man, this team is about as widely. We could go. I mean, we could win 5-6 games, or we could lose. Or we could win 10 or 11.
Yeah.
It's like last year. We went.
Yeah,
I can't get a
handle on these guys because of the offense. I just don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the defense is going to be very good, but, you've got to have some offense. If we'd had any kind of offense last year, it could have been a truly memorable season.
Yeah.
But we just couldn't.
We made it to number two. We were 10-4, and we were 3-0 in one score games. If that goes the other way, it's a difference between a 7-7 team and a number two ranked team in the country. That's crazy.
Yeah.
There were many times
true.
Last year where we looked like a 7-7 team, to be honest.
Absolutely. That's a scary
thing. So here's the funny thing. I was talking about the consensus on the East. On the West, the consensus is, for the most part, Wisconsin. But there are Dennis Dodd has Iowa winning the West. So, in the big in ESPN's power rankings of the Big Ten, of just the Big Ten teams, it's Ohio State, Michigan State, and Iowa. They have us again ahead of Wisconsin. So,
that's interesting because the AP and the coaches don't seem to believe that we're better than Wisconsin.
Well, we're the number.
And
I
don't know if we are or not. My view with Iowa and Wisconsin is until we really establish we can beat them. Which, other than that COVID year when Wisconsin was way down, we haven't since 2015. Look, Iowa, you can almost tie memorable Iowa seasons into did we beat Wisconsin? It's really
2015.
Right. And then
I mean, we had decent.
Could have been a great year, but
ago.
Yeah, we had decent seasons after that, but none that you could call great because we didn't beat Wisconsin, you know. I mean, even last year, not beating them, we backed, in a sense, backed into the Big Ten title game, but
right, and this is another year where we have, you know, Wisconsin's coming into Kinnick, and Iowa needs to get the win on this for the good of the program and the rivalry.
Yeah, so
our defense can rival the 81 defense, you know, with Campbell.
Yeah.
Van Ness is making huge. That guy is one of those. He's like Campbell. Campbell comes in. He's a classic Iowa kid, three-star,
and
190-pound linebacker, and just works.
Yeah,
now he's 6'5".
And Joe Evans.
That 1981 defense was absolutely. I'll never forget though, before my sophomore year, thinking at the time, you know what? I'll bet we'll be good. I remember reading like a preseason magazine that had us like picked like 7th, and I remember thinking, you know what? I think these people are, because I think our defense is really going to be good. At the end of 1980, I remember looking at our defense and saying, well, this is a good defense, you know. I mean, it was the offense that sucked at that time, and so that was the problem with the 1981 team. In the long term, was that they didn't have the offensive numbers. But yeah, if we have that kind of defense, I certainly wouldn't be unhappy. That's for sure. So,
but what did that remember? What, and I remember that game because I actually took a road trip to Iowa City before I even went there and hung out with some friends. That year, 81. What was the key game really for Iowa? Beating Wisconsin up in Madison, if you remember.
Madison, and Wisconsin, that's right. At the
beginning of the game, Bill Fleming calling the game, by the way.
Yeah.
At the beginning of that game, it was all about Wisconsin. All Wisconsin needs to do if they can beat Iowa. Wisconsin had a good team. Remember, Tim Crumry was a great defensive lineman.
Well, don't forget,
they had to do was beat Iowa to go to the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, well, they beat Michigan to open that season on opening day. The day we beat Nebraska, Wisconsin beat Michigan. And then Wisconsin also, I believe, beat Ohio State.
And if you remember how that game went, by the way, Hayden Fry, traditional, wasn't flashy. Iowa just ran the ball. Threw off a couple big plays by Bohannon on a couple passes.
He did some quarterback draw.
17-0 at halftime.
Yeah.
And frankly, the
defense
over.
And Reggie Roby won that game, basically.
Yep,
the defense and Reggie Roby. I remember Roby hitting two punts out of bounds inside the 10. You know, like 50-yard punts out of bounds. I mean, that was just – yeah, if we had
–
If
you gave that defense a 17-0 lead, they were not going to lose.
Yeah.
They held UCLA and Nebraska under 10 points.
Yeah. I mean, what did we beat Nebraska 10-7, the UCLA 21-10? I mean, you know, that year the Iowa State loss was kind of a fluke, actually. So, you know.
The key point is, really, Wisconsin game is always pivotal. Iowa wins that game. The years when Iowa really has a good, solid teams and real success, they beat Wisconsin.
Yep. Exactly. So, okay, so next game on our schedule, game 5, Michigan at home. Andy, start with you. What do you expect is going to happen? Obviously, we want to win, but what do you think it's going to take for us to win?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll take some turnovers. I mean, that was a really disheartening loss when we played them at the end of last year because, I mean, they dominated us. Like, it wasn't a fluke. I mean, it was just they manhandled us now. You know, hopefully they, you know, suck it up and learn from that. But, you know, I'm not real optimistic about this one.
Really? Okay. I mean, I think they have so many losses that aren't being talked about that, you know. So and frankly,
I'm a little more optimistic than Andy Hawk, although I understand why he's pessimistic because he's right. We got dominated in that game. Iowa could do nothing offensively on that defense. And that was a truly outstanding defense, as Ohio State will tell you. But they've lost a lot of people. Now, I think Michigan's still going to be a solid team, but I do think that coming into Kinnick, and by the way, look at just the last 15, 20 years, Michigan does not do well in Kinnick Stadium.
Correct.
And a lot of Michigan teams really favor, remember that 2016 year, they're 9-0.
Yep.
And they come in there and Iowa spanks them. And that Iowa team was a team that was struggling. We talked about that. It was the year they lost to North Dakota State, but they beat Michigan.
And Michigan does not have a good track record of coming into Iowa in October in the last, 15, 20 years. And yeah. I do think there'll be a little payback for Iowa. If Iowa's any good, I'm picking that as a real upset possibly. Who knows, right? But I don't think Michigan will be quite the team they were last year. And I think Iowa, if they have the team I'm hopeful they'll have, will give them fits in Kinnick.
Okay. So let's go to Illinois. Any worries there?
Is that game at Bloomington? I think it is.
Yeah.
No, Illinois. We don't play. No, it's in Champaign, yep. Atlanta.
I mean, Bloomington. Champaign.
Yeah, it's at a road game.
Players, a player committing suicide because Champaign is so depressing is a possibility.
Right, but I mean, look, any Big Ten road game for Iowa always kind of scares me. Just leave it at that.
Yeah,
just like at Minnesota.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
Also, it's wedged in between Michigan and Ohio State for us, so.
Yeah.
It's Beal and that's, Tommy was really high on Illinois last year.
Yeah, Brother Tommy was really high.
Maybe picked him every maybe he was a year off.
I know. Well, I hope he was 2 years off. But, that's you think about it. We get Michigan, then we go to Illinois, and then we have a week off, and then we go to Ohio State. So two road games in a row,
right.
Naturally. I'm sure nobody else has that, but we get it. So I don't know. Indy, what are your thoughts? Do you really think you think Bielema is going to turn it around there?
I don't think so. I mean, I think this is it's a tough, you gave us some categories, Hank, tough if you win. That's what I put it down as. I think the Hawks win. I just, I'm hoping we've already talked about it, but it depends on Petrus and the consistency and the offensive line. What the heck was that last year?
Yep.
Hopefully we had progress. Yep. It should be the same offensive line. We're a factory. But, get that going. And, I think we win that game in 20 to 14 or, not a blowout, but a tough one. But we win it. That's the games we win.
Mike, your thought on that one?
I guess I keep coming back to the fact that I'm optimistic about Iowa in any game, but I just this offense has me scared a little bit, and I just don't know what to expect. I mean, I expect the line to be better, but I don't. You start really asking me details on that. I kind of don't know why. I guess I just assume that people are going to be better this year. I think I've seen stuff that Ferentz is optimistic, I think I'll have a better gauge on all the Big Ten games after the first couple games of the season. And it's just kind of a crapshoot because the offense was so, I have to say, so poor last year and so disappointing in so many games. I guess we can only go up, but we really need to step up.
Yeah.
This year has
to be the
most unpredictable year in years for Iowa. I mean, look at the difference in the season last year. It was black and white.
What scares me about Illinois, they had some big wins last year at Minnesota, at Penn State, going on the road. They did beat Nebraska. Now, I'm not saying Nebraska's any great shakes, but they did beat them, on the other hand, I'm not sure how good Bielema is without Barry Alvarez around. He really didn't get it done at Arkansas, and he hasn't really gotten it done at Illinois. I mean, he's been okay. He's certainly, not embarrassed himself.
Illinois is a tough place, let's be honest. Look at, Lovie couldn't do it. But we'll see.
Yeah, I just think Lovie was.
They got a transfer quarterback named Tommy DeVito. Is that any relation to Vito?
They have a transfer. Where's he from?
Syracuse. Magazine. I got Tommy DeVito.
Tommy DeVito.
Let's see how Illinois does against Wyoming Saturday, because I think that could be watch out there.
Yeah.
So let's do confidence. Rank them 1 to 6. What's your number one ranked game that you're most confident for this for Iowa for the first half? Andy, go with yours first. What's the game you're most confident in the first 6 games?
Nevada.
Nevada. Okay, Mike, how about you?
Hey, I have to say it's either Iowa State or Nevada, but I think I would agree on Nevada.
Okay, and your number two, Indy?
I guess South Dakota State.
Okay, and Mike, how about you?
I would say Iowa State, possibly Rutgers,
okay.
But I'd probably say Iowa State.
Okay, and your number three most
first game of the year.
Number three most confidence, Mike. Your number three most confident game.
I would say Rutgers. I think that's like the first Big Ten opener, 5th game of the year, and I'm always nervous on the road, like I said. But I just and I think Rutgers is getting marginally better. But I think they kind of took some steps backward toward the last half of the season last year.
Right.
I think I'll probably match up and beat them.
Right. Okay, Indy. How about you? You're number three.
Rutgers.
Okay, and number four. For Indy, what's your number four?
Go Iowa State.
Okay. Mike, your number four?
South Dakota State, I think.
Okay. And number five, I would say, I'm going to guess your number fives are both Illinois and your number six is Michigan?
Yes.
Would that be safe for both of you?
Absolutely. I guess I would agree with that.
Yeah. Okay, so Indy, obviously conference games are must win, but of the first six, which would be the most to you would be the most painful if they lost? Which one would just grate on you more than any other?
Well, I would not include the preseason games because the pre-conference. I would say Rutgers and Illinois because we need to win those.
Yeah. Mike, a different question.
I agree.
A different question, Mike. Do you think we are going to be seeing an end to the Cy-Hawk series?
Oh, that's an interesting question. If we go to these mega conference things, all bets are off. Like, you go to 20 or 20 plus teams, and then you're playing in pods. I don't even know exactly how that works out. But you could be theoretically in a situation where you don't have, you're just playing teams in the mega conference. That's it. But as long as we stay roughly where we're at right now, I don't think that we'll stop playing. As long as we have a couple of non-conference games a year, we'll play Iowa State. There's just, I don't necessarily embrace the idea. It's always kind of seems like a downside for me. Iowa, if you win, they expect it. And if you lose, you never hear the end of it. But I think that there's just the whole, sort of situation in the state is that, politically even two land grant schools, they're going to have to play each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say for me, but okay. So let's get to this weekend's games. The first one, Nebraska and Northwestern square off in Dublin, Ireland of all places. Obviously, Scott Frost is needs a big season this year. I think if he goes 7-5, he's got a shot at keeping his job. If he were to win a bowl game, that would probably help as well. But I don't know. But it's in Dublin. Who knows? Andy, your thoughts on this game?
Frost is still there. Let me change my pick quick.
By midseason, Trev Albert will be the athletic director.
Yeah, interesting stat here. I just found it in my magazine that I bought. Northwestern has won the West in the last two even numbered years.
Now, 18 and 20 to have.
I think.
That's right. I think that's right. Absolutely right.
They won the last. He's right. Absolutely.
And they
right.
beat Iowa both of those years. Yeah.
So, Northwestern. And
even
here,
even Frost, come on.
Yeah. That's I have to say, and maybe it's a little bit of wish thing because I'd love this to happen, but I'm picking Northwestern too, and here's why. For the reasons that Indy Hawk touched on, maybe it was you, Hank, but the Northwestern had a bad year last year, but they don't, under Fitzgerald, they don't have usually two bad years in a row. They bounce back. And so I expect Northwestern to bounce back, and they're going to be ready to play in Dublin. I don't know whether Nebraska is, but I just think Nebraska's kind of hapless with Frost, and they get all hyped up. They may think they're going to win the national championship this year. I don't know. Nebraska fans are kind of delusional. I think Northwestern's going to beat them. I think Northwestern's going to be tougher this year, and they don't usually have two bad years in a row. So I'm going Northwestern.
Yeah, here's what I don't get. Yeah, what I don't get, I'm not sure what either team really, loses, gains, whatever. I know Nebraska has a new quarterback, that Casey Thompson or whatever, transfer from Texas, I think, is the new quarterback. Northwestern, it's Ryan Helinski. I think that Hunter Johnson is finally gone. I think he finally went somewhere else, or he may finally have finished his career. But I think it's Ryan Helinski for Northwestern. And, he didn't exactly light it up, in his time there. I just Northwestern is really sort of has had to have good quarterbacks to do it. You know what I mean? I don't know. I just don't know that they've solved any of their losses in terms of personnel. Now, they do have a kid, Calvin Johnson II, at wide receiver. I don't know if it's the relation to Calvin Johnson, the primo receiver of years gone by.
The first?
Yeah.
be a letdown if it wasn't.
Well, let's look him up. I mean, I'm looking at it now. It's just – I just don't know what they really replace. But on the other hand, when you ask is Frost a better coach than Pat Fitzgerald, I personally can unequivocally say no, he's not. Pat Fitzgerald is a better coach than Scott Frost. I totally agree. I don't have any problem arguing that. Scott Frost certainly had success at UCF, and he certainly should be commended for that. He took a team, was celebrated, and took him undefeated. He beat Auburn in a bowl game, all that stuff. I mean, that's a props to him. But I think he's in over his head in the Big Ten. I think he thought that he was going to coach the way he coached at UCF, which was a team built on speed and outside. And you can't do that in the Big Ten. You've got to have an inside game in the Big Ten, no matter what your modus operandi is. If you're a basketball on grass team, you've still got to be strong in the trenches, and they're not. And whereas Northwestern typically is decent in the trenches, even in their not so good years. So, yeah, I just don't think he's as good a coach. So, yeah, I would agree. I would go with Northwestern. I mean, I just don't. The bigger question is, does Scott Frost keep his job the whole season? Does he make it the whole season? Andy, you think so?
Go ahead, Andy.
I do. I think he will. I don't know if they fire him mid-season. They waited this long. What's one more year?
Well, but how tolerant is Trev Alberts going to be? What do you think, Mike?
He's been very tolerant so far.
Well, obviously it depends on how he does. But if they and I'll tell you what, if they lose Northwestern, the rumbling will already start. But if they if they're like. Remember the problem last year was I think they were 3-9, but I think like 7 out of their 9 losses were one score games where they led. So I mean that's a real problem when you can't hold leads like that. But I think that as long as it's not a complete collapse early in the season, that I would agree with Indy Hawk that he probably stays, and then they make the move at the end of the year. But if they start out like 0-5 or something, I think they might fire him right off the bat. I doubt that probably won't happen. I think they have some fairly easy non-conference games, but you know, if they lose to Northwestern and then drop a game or two in non-conference, I think he might not make it.
He's in his fifth year. It's crazy.
I know. That's what's kind of shocking to me, is that already in his fifth year. I mean, I just didn't even, you know. But yeah, he basically, after that 2017 year at UCF, you know, he had that year and he was like, you know, and UCF actually went undefeated the next year and probably would have competed better in their bowl game if Mackenzie Milton, their quarterback, hadn't gone down against South Florida, you know. I mean, that guy was an absolute stud. So, you know,
He started off slow at Nebraska and then tapered off.
I mean, here's their schedule. They've got Northwestern, and then they've got North Dakota, Georgia Southern. Okay, fine. Then they've got Oklahoma, Indiana, and Rutgers next.
Yeah.
Purdue, I mean, Illinois. I mean, I'm not seeing a lot. I'm actually not seeing that many wins for them. I'm seeing North Dakota, Georgia Southern, Indiana, Rutgers. I mean, they have to go to Rutgers, too. They have to go to Purdue. You know, they haven't beaten Minnesota in forever. They're at Michigan. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, I see, realistically, I see 1, 2, 3, I see 4 to 6 wins for them at max. I mean, I don't see how anybody's talking about seven or eight wins for that team.
Hank, I think your original question was, you know, will he make it to the end of the year? And I think if he doesn't lose to Georgia Southern or North Dakota, which probably that won't happen, then he probably will be able to finish the year. If he loses one of those games, I think that all bets are off.
Yeah.
And his best conference year was 3 wins in the Big Ten, his first three. And they had one win last year.
But they were the best darn 3-9 team in the country.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what does that get you? Yeah, what does that get you?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Wyoming at Illinois. Mike, your thought on this one.
Well, I'll touch on this a little bit. I think you got to be careful. Wyoming will come in there, and they'll be run and shoot. And, you know, Illinois, if you go by last year, they had some good games, and then they had some games where they, you know, I think they lost to like Buffalo or somebody. They started the year out, they upset Nebraska.
They lost to Texas, San Antonio. I mean, no, their schedule.
Oh,
last
that's
year
right, that's the, right. And by the way, they were a decent team, UTSA.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Oh,
about
yeah.
But I think that I'm just kind of picking that as an upset alert. I think Illinois will be favored. They'll probably win. It's at Illinois, but I keep my eye on that. That is a potential upset.
Yeah.
First game of the year.
But if you got to pick a team, who are you going to pick? You going to pick Illinois?
Yeah, I'll pick Illinois.
Okay, Andy, how about you? What's your thought?
I'm going to go. I'll go Illinois. And they did show some life at the end of last year. They won 3 of their last 5, they upset Penn State and Minnesota, and both ranked. And then, like I said, Vito's cousin, the quarterback, see how he does as a starter.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing that kind of has wondering, like I said, I'm not real confident that, I mean, I don't think they're going to lose to Wyoming. I mean, I think that's kind of stupid to even say. But I'm not all that confident in Brett Bielema without Barry Alvarez around. I'm just not. I mean,
right.
Wyoming, you know, had a decent year last year.
I'm telling you, don't be so quick to dismiss Wyoming. I, as I said, I picked Illinois, but I think that's it's one of those games that they, you know, you be a little careful. I think Illinois probably got the better team, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll win.
Yeah. True. I
First
mean,
game
I,
of the year,
I think.
You know, Stuff can happen. Yeah. Stuff can happen. Turnovers, things like that. Wyoming won't have anything to lose, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we went into that one game against Wyoming a few years ago, and everybody talked about, you know, this Josh Allen, and this could be the, you know, an upset alert and all that kind of stuff. Because we, frankly, you know, years before that, we had lost to North Dakota State. But, You know, I just think, you know, for a Mountain West team to come into the a Big Ten stadium, in a sense, I mean, really, the coaches, the other Big Ten coaches should be on the phone with Brett Bielema and say, dude, you cannot lose this one. In terms of our conference saving face, you cannot lose this one.
And that's why I am picking Illinois, because I do think they'll probably win. I just think it could be a closer game than you might think.
Yeah. I would agree. I think Illinois wins it. But like I said, I'm not confident in Brett Bielema beyond, you know, without Barry Alvarez around. So in the meantime, hey, guys, we're up against it. So hope you guys will come back next week, and we'll talk Big Ten West. And we'll talk more Hawkeye football, of course. And we'll have a fuller schedule to talk about that as well. So in the meantime, thanks for being here. And we will talk next week. Sound good?
Okay.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Okay, great, guys. We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Okay, folks, you've heard our first week of preseason or preview, Big Ten preview and football preview. You know, the consensus is that Iowa can have a good team. Obviously, the big worry, you know, what's our offensive line going to be like? That's really what it boils down to. In terms of the Big Ten East, yeah, I think it's Ohio State and everybody else. And I think, you know, last year was kind of an anomaly, maybe. I just think it really boils down to Ohio State's the best team in the conference, and that's that. So in the meantime, hey, be safe. Have a great rest of the week. Have a great weekend, and we will see you all next week. I want to thank Boyd for being here, the Alaskan, and Indy Hawk in the chat room. Sue from New Mexico, my big sister, Mike, a couple others on the phones. Have a great week. Have a great weekend, folks. Thank you.